What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Healthspan Academy. I'm your host, Craig Shearhart, and joining me today is Dr. Joe Bauer. Joe started his academic career at the Bachelor of Science in Chemistry from Acadia University, and then went on to complete a PhD from UT Southwestern Medical Center, and then completed a postdoc from Harvard Medical School. And since then, has started a career as an associate professor in physiology from University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. And his research focuses on molecular mechanisms of aging and metabolism, and he's done a lot of really cool work in the field of NAD. So we're going to talk a little bit about that whole spectrum, his latest research, and what's going on in the academic world of Joe Bauer. Joe, thanks for joining me today, man.
Craig, thanks for having me.
Cool. So let's kick this off with how you fell into the field of longevity and aging research originally. How did that all sort of unfold?
I was actually always interested in aging. You know, I kind of came up even in high school thinking about my two major interests being biology and physics.
Okay.
And, you know, ultimately, you know, literally made the decision that I was just a lot more interested in the result I was going to get from studying aging, you know, the physics. I was interested in the math and some of these hypotheticals, but I just, you know, loved that sort of practical aspect of, you know, where you see aging all around us. And I really wanted to understand that.
Wow. That's crazy. I feel like a lot of us just are getting into it later in life. So you're definitely ahead of the curve. And then as you got into grad school, you got more applied. Give me kind of a broad stroke of what your graduate work was focused on.
My graduate work was on telomeres. So even an undergraduate, I was taking courses looking for some exposure to the aging field. And that was around the time it had been shown that you could immortalize cells, right?
So
it was known for a while that human cells in a dish only replicate a certain number of times. Mm-hmm. That was known as the Hayflick limit.
Yeah.
And Jerry Shea and Woody Wright, who I eventually went on to do my PhD with, had just shown that you could put this enzyme called telomerase back in to extend the ends of telomeres, which are the ends of chromosomes, on every cell division. And that would allow the cells to go forever. So that would really establish
that
those telomeres were the limiting factor in allowing cells to divide. And at the time, it was really thought that that might be the reason we age, right? That cells might run out of divisions.
Yeah.
So that, you know, it's a lot more subtle than that.
So that
is not really proven to be the, you know, core mechanism of aging, although it is a modifying factor and something that's still being studied widely.
Yeah. So that was one of the core kind of conversations, I guess. There was buzz going around the world. I think that people thought we could maybe live forever at that point. I think that's sort of come back to earth a little bit. Is that sort of where we stand now?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think if you're a cancer cell, you can live forever that way. It is the mechanism by which a lot of cancer cells are able to keep dividing beyond what would have been the limit.
Yeah, fair enough.
But you know, as far as the overall organism biology, it's a little different. But so my project, that was discovered just before I joined. That was really what really attracted me to the lab.
Yeah.
What I came in to study was the effect of telomeres on genes that were nearby.
Okay.
So it was this idea that genes near the ends of chromosomes might get silenced. And the original, you know, phrasing of this hypothesis called telomere position effect was that region of silenced genes, as the telomeres got shorter, might move farther into the chromosome and catch more genes.
Oh, interesting.
So the setup for my project was that I was going to look for things that got silenced as telomeres shortened. What I actually found was that silencing effect is there, but it disappears as the telomeres get short.
Oh, wow.
So I saw genes getting reactivated spontaneously that shouldn't have been as telomeres
shortened. That's wild. That threw you a bit of a curveball, I guess, eh?
Exactly.
Crazy. And since then, you've kind of shifted more towards NAD. And this, I just feel like the whole field is blown up with papers on NAD. So, and this is, what's your elevator pitch on how you approach the problem? What exactly NAD, its role, its relation to ATP, and why it's important, and why this research is blown up?
Yes. I mean, so I think NAD is as fundamental as ATP, right? It's one of these basic molecules. You know, and people tend not to know as much about it if they're not working in biochemistry because it's complicated, right? It's participating in all sorts of, you know, detailed reactions that people wanted to forget about after getting out of advanced biochem courses.
Yeah.
but it really, it is, you know, the major tool that the cell uses to sort of take electrons out or put electrons into reactions. And it's really needed, you know, for just the basics of energy production. You have no consistent way to make ATP in a cell without NAD.
Right.
And it's lethal to any cell to not have NAD.
Yeah. And we're seeing now that the decline in NAD is one of the most like key features, I guess, associated with aging. And it just like, even after the teens, you're seeing it just like completely teeters off. And that's like, they're starting to relate that to some of the phenotype of like expression of aging, more or less. And we know it's so, and we know it's also important in cardiac function. And that's been, you've done a little bit of work on that. Talk through its specific role when we talk about heart function and cardiac.
Right. So first, I mean, I just want to, there's a push and a pull on the aging aspect, right? So it's consistently shown to go down with age.
Yeah.
And obviously this triggers some alarm bells. This like essential, molecule is going away with age. And do we need to put it back? The degree to which it's going away with age, sort of depends from experiment to experiment. Sometimes it looks pretty dramatic. Sometimes it looks a little bit more subtle.
Okay.
And I think that's really a challenge for the field, is to prove that, that the amount of decline that we're seeing with age or in some of the diseases actually matters.
Yeah.
Because I mean, obviously if you go to zero, you're dead, but
yeah,
there may be some more wiggle room in there and you really have to figure that out. And in cases that we've even had some specific cases, like where we've knocked out NAD synthesis in skeletal muscle, and we can make mice that have extremely low skeletal muscle NAD levels and are kind of okay when they're young.
Wow.
Much lower than you would see in aged skeletal muscle.
Huh.
So that kind of raises the question of do the levels of decrease you see with aging actually matter or not?
Right.
Which brings up another related question in the field, which is the resolution that we can do these assays at is terrible. So one possible resolution to this sort of paradox that I just mentioned is that individual cells within the muscle, individual muscle fibers, may have greatly depleted NAD levels in aged individuals and others not.
Right.
We're almost exclusively reliant on assays where we mash up the whole muscle, and the average isn't down that far.
Right. So it could be, if I'm following you here, that could mean that there's just less fibers available for contraction. So it might be like they have less power or speed, I guess. Is that sort of the line of thinking there?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a hypothesis, but I think that sort of thing would help reconcile some of these seemingly conflicting data where you
can
get pretty large declines in NAD sometimes that don't seem to have such a big consequence.
Yeah.
Compared to these more subtle ones in tissue averages with age.
Right. So they're able to live, just not like in a really efficient fight or flight state, I guess, is the way you could look at it.
Right. Well, so we saw, I mean, when we evaluated them at about 3 months of age, the muscle specific knockouts that we had made, it was really hard to tell them from wild type animals.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, they could run normally at that age.
Oh, wow.
And, they walked around in the cage normally. When we aged them to about 7 months, which is still really young for mice, things started to fall apart. Right? They go off the rails and they get what's called kyphotic. So they get this characteristic hump in their back.
Especially
premature aging mice get, and they could no longer run. And if we took the mitochondria out of those muscle tissues, they were dysfunctional at that age.
Hmm.
But the NAD decline had started much earlier.
Huh. Interesting. Cool. We know it has a huge role in cognition too. How much do we know about the role and how that impacts like at a human level? I assume we're taking a little bit of extraction from animal studies and stuff like that. Have we mapped out the role of the key role in NAD in terms of cognition?
No, so there's been 7 or 8 rodent studies now all sort of agreeing that in Alzheimer's disease models or in other models with cognitive deficits that NAD precursors seem to be beneficial.
Yeah.
Right now, there's no human studies to back that up. There was a recently published one called NAD Park, which was the first attempt to use NAD precursors in Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that showed a very mild protective effect.
Okay.
It was, sort of at the level where they had to derive sort of a signature of how brain metabolism was altered by NAD supplementation and then correlate that signature with the functional scores in the Alzheimer's patients.
Okay.
So it's sort of a highly derived metric and kind of a subtle effect, but there was, some interest there, some promise.
Yeah.
And so certainly would be many, many more studies following on the heels of that.
Interesting. Do you feel like that kind of follows suit with like the impact of creatine on cognition?
I think in general, energetic stress is kind of a theme of, cognitive problems in the brain, and a lot of these things that get involved in energy metabolism are likely to be beneficial.
Yeah, fair enough. Let's talk about, the other kind of chronic sort of inflammatory issue that's been linked to NAD is insulin sensitivity and in extreme cases, diabetes. Talk about NAD's role there and what you've kind of found in some of the literature.
Right. So insulin sensitivity has been one of the first test cases for a phenotype to try to translate to humans. And so in mice, you know, again, it works really well, right? You can definitely improve glucose levels and improve insulin sensitivity in animal models. And multiple groups have shown that using different NAD precursors. In the first human trial that was really well done with a decent number of people on this subject, they did a pretty high dose. You know, they did hyperinsulinemic euglycemic clamps, which are sort of the state of the art, best, you know, gold standard assays for insulin sensitivity, and really weren't able to show anything. So this was sort of the first, you know, sort of direct failure to take a really clear mouse phenotype of these molecules and just not see it in the humans.
Right.
And so this is a lot of the discussion in the field right now is sort of why didn't that one work?
Yeah. Interesting.
One possibility that I, you know, worry about quite a bit is the dose translation. And so the tendency with normal drugs is to do what's called allometric scaling. So you do things like compare body surface area or something because it approximates the dose that you'll need to go, you know, from a mouse to a human. So humans, by body weight, end up getting, you know, 12 or 15 fold less than the mice. And people have tried to do that with the NAD precursors too. And in part because we don't have safety data on massive doses in the mice that get massive doses.
Yeah, it'd be tough to get active threat, eh?
But when it comes to boosting NAD levels, right, the NAD concentration in human and mouse tissues is about the same. And the turnover time in human and mouse cells is about the same.
Huh.
And so I think there's a real possibility we need to scale by body weight if we want to see the same effect.
Yeah, fair enough. What is the workaround for that? Could we move to a larger animal that's like, it's a smaller distance, I guess, to extrapolate from? Or like, what is the next step?
Right. So we are working on that now, actually, moving into larger animals to try to replicate some of these points. In my lab, one of the things we've been doing a lot of is using heavy isotope tracers. Right? So we use molecules that in a mass spectrometer, you can distinguish from the endogenous versions. Right? So we can give, say, nicotinamide riboside as an NAD precursor that has these heavy atoms on it. And then we can later extract NAD from tissues and determine if it came from that nicotinamide riboside that we gave from the same natural molecules.
Okay.
And so doing that kind of study, we've shown that almost all of the dose when you take it orally of these molecules gets broken down into simpler forms of vitamin B3 before taken up. And if we give intravenous dosing, almost all of it gets to the target tissues. Huh. And so I think one possibility is that the delivery route is going to have to change to use reasonable doses in humans.
Right.
And there's really a lot of possibility there to dramatically increase the efficacy of some of these things.
Fair enough. So, yeah, and you hear about like some of the longevity gurus like Ben Greenfield and Dave Asprey taking IV NAD. And then last I heard it was a split because it is a signaling molecule. And we're not sure what the impact is if we inject. Is there any developments with that? Do we know if there are like implications of taking it intravenously?
No, we don't. And so that whole school of thought has a weird history that's actually uncoupled from most of what the rest of us in sort of basic research have been doing with NAD. Mm-hmm. You know, this was running in parallel from the psychology field. There was a couple of old studies where schizophrenics were treated with intravenous NAD. And apparently showed some promise. There were a bunch of case reports written. And the guy who was doing most of the studies actually had one big batch synthesized. He ran out of it.
Huh.
Took all the patients off. Supposedly, a lot of them relapsed, and he just really wrote a lot of case reports and sort of stepped away from that line of research at the time. And this was picked up by different people over the years who've been running these clinics. And so these intravenous NAD clinics have sort of been an independent entity for a while.
Yeah,
a lot of them are now used to treat addiction, and I've seen cases where they've claimed to treat Parkinson's disease with this. But they are not publishing, in scientific journals. For the most part, there's almost no sort of peer-reviewed evidence for that line of investigation at all. It's all anecdotal.
Yeah, biohacking at its purest.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's been funny, actually, just at a couple of the NAD meetings over the last few years, some of the people who have been doing intravenous NAD have shown up
at
these meetings. And the worlds have just started to collide. It's only been really a few years where that's been happening.
That's wild. So, I mean, it's kind of a black box at this point, then, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a really long way of saying there's nothing to evaluate that I'm aware of for intravenous NAD.
Fair enough. So we talked kind of beforehand. We know autophagy is kind of a big deal. And do we know how much that relates to NAD? Can NAD be a stimulus to create autophagy or kind of like stimulate when we we pair that with something that we know is linked to it, like intermittent fasting. Is there a role with NAD in relation to autophagy and sort of cell regeneration, or do we know that?
No, I mean, I'd say there's correlations. A lot of the states that cause NAD synthesis to go up or NAD concentration to go up are also inducing autophagy. So when you're starving cells, one of the main energy sensors is called AMPK. It's AMP, activated protein kinase. That activates expression of nicotinamide phosphorybosyltransferase, which is the rate limiting step for NAD synthesis. So the sort of starvation response, you know, necessarily involves making more NAD in many cells. The only really direct connection that I'm aware of mechanistically is that one of the enzymes that consumes NAD is SIRT1, one of the SIRT1 enzymes, deacetylates LC3, which is a key component of the autophagy machinery.
Right.
And so it's acetylated, it can be trapped in the nucleus, and SIRT1 essentially deacetylates it and frees it up to go participate in autophagy. So there is that one direct mechanistic link, but for the most part, they're more correlated than directly causal, as far as we know.
Fair enough. Cool. I want to circle back a little bit to your work with telomeres. I feel like that's like, is that still kind of on the radar with respect to aging? Or is it just like a symptomatic piece to it? Is there, and is that the link to NAD? Or what is the latest?
Well, so I'll tell you first my own path through this was that first in yeast where telomere position effect was discovered, and later in human cells it was shown that sirtuin enzymes, which are NAD dependent, are causing that silencing.
Okay.
So in yeast it's an enzyme called SIRT2 that's going to telomeres and actually silencing the adjacent genes.
Right.
SIRT1 that I just mentioned was the closest homolog in mammalian cells. And so I actually set out to prove it was SIRT1 at mammalian telomeres as well. It completely wasn't, and you know, abandoned that line of research as I went off to do my postdoc work.
Right.
In my own lab, and it was turned out to be SIRT6, just one of the family members who was shown by another group to actually be
interesting. The mammalian version of that. Is that just like chance that you chose a different signaling piece, or?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, it was the one that was sort of by homology, the closest.
Okay,
to
gotcha. So
it was the most obvious candidate, but there were a few that were viable, and one of
fair
the
enough. That's a little frustrating.
But that was what. Yeah. So that's fair what enough. Really got me going on the on NAD in the first place.
Okay. You know,
got me thinking that line.
Awesome. So I watched your recent take on your presentation on. A lot of it was focused around SLC25A51, which you've identified as a key piece to metabolism, I guess, of NAD. Talk about what exactly that is, and how much we know about that in its role of NAD synthesis.
Yeah. So this highlights one of the the other problems in the field, right? This field has been exploding, but almost everything that's being done is by giving loads of NAD precursors, boosting NAD everywhere, and looking downstream at what's the consequence on some disease readout.
Right.
And what we're kind of realizing the longer we do this is we know how little we know about how NAD is really controlled within the cell, compartmentalized, and we particularly got interested in how NAD was getting inside of mitochondria, which are the powerhouses of the cell. Right. This is where we're actually generating most of the ATP for the cell. They're enclosed organelles. They have an inside lumen that contains some NAD, and it was unknown how it got there. In fact, it was hotly debated. There were a few different models when we got involved in this. And so using these heavy isotope tracer studies that I mentioned before, we were able to show to our satisfaction that NAD from the cytosol, so from the rest of the cell, was getting imported inside the mitochondria, which was one of the three models that have been argued about. So we came out strongly in support of that one, but we still didn't know how. So that set us up on this path and a couple of other groups also looking for this transporter. And so three of us simultaneously published it at the end of 2020.
Oh, wow.
Identified this as SLC25A51, which is... So SLC is solute carrier family. 25A is ones that are annotated to go to mitochondria.
Okay.
And 51's the sequential number given to this one. So it's sort of a systematic name. And there was nothing published on this gene at all. It had shown up in some lists for essential genes where people had done whole genome screens and just listed everything the cell couldn't live without. And it was on some of those lists. So it made, arguing that it was going to be something really important, but there was absolutely no annotation of what it did. Before this. And so, like I said, three simultaneous papers we described it, and there's still, I think, seven or eight total papers that mention it on PubMed.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. And so it's obviously still fairly new discovery. Do we, have we been able to link like other factors that might cause, like facilitate a, like more efficiency with that, or as a transporter, like dietary means, or is there, do we know, this is still pretty new, I assume. How much do we know about how much we can impact how well it works or efficiency?
So we don't know much.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a few interesting things about it, which is that this type of transporter generally is a counter transporter. So usually there's something going the other way when the NAD goes in. And we don't know what that is for this protein, but there's certainly a possibility that, you know, if we can supplement whatever the other thing is, that it will get transported in and then exchange out to push NAD into mitochondria. Right. So maybe some way to approach that. The other thing that we know is that there are circumstances in which mitochondria actively pick up NAD. Mm-hmm. So this pathway can be stimulated. So one of them that my lab works on a lot is liver regeneration.
Okay. So
we'll cut out 2/3 of the liver and it'll regrow in mice. And we've really gotten interested in studying that more and more because it seems to depend on NAD, how fast the liver can regrow. Mm-hmm. But one of the other things we see is that as the liver is regrowing, NAD levels are down to about half, right? They fall and become limiting for how fast it can regenerate. Hmm. At the same time, the mitochondria in the liver have more NAD. So they've really just sucked up the remaining
interesting.
NAD
rapidly. Huh. And is, do you have a theory behind what's going on there?
No, I think there's a lot of biosynthetic reactions that are going through mitochondrial intermediates. And I mean, our take on it has been that the rate of some of those reactions is just limited by how much NAD is available in the mitochondria. And so that the cells are prioritizing that under a condition where they need to grow as fast as possible. They prioritize getting those things in and out of mitochondria to keep all the pathways running.
Okay, fair enough. And you had a few slides where you showed some the SLC 25A51. It takes me a while to read that out every time. And you were linking that to different types of cancer. Can you talk through some of those findings as well?
Yeah. So this is, you know, this is online research essentially through databases. So this is the human protein atlas.
Yeah.
And what we discovered was that there were data in there showing that high levels of expression of this gene were associated with poor outcomes in liver cancer and thyroid cancer, which is what we had sort of feared, that, you know, that if you boosted mitochondrial function in these tumors, they might grow even faster and even worse. But the interesting result was that in kidney cancers, high levels of this gene were associated with good outcomes. Mm-hmm. And kidney cancers are kind of famous for being highly glycolytic. So they choose not to make their ATP with mitochondria, but to rely on sort of the cytosolic pathways that produce ATP and shut down their mitochondria. And so it's really intriguing to us that for cells that want to have that type of metabolism, we may be able to actually, you know, inhibit cancer growth by forcing the NAD into the mitochondria.
Yeah, that's a kind of wild thing. And I guess there's no real way to target it if it's cancer, or maybe somewhere down the line, but we're not there yet, I assume.
No, but I think we're working on developing inhibitors. So for the former types, for the liver and the thyroid, right? The cells that like to have it, we may be able to selectively inhibit their growth.
Cool. This is fascinating. I love this. I want to talk a little, like, briefed over like fasting. And we know that like there's lifestyle pieces that we know have been linked to NAD boost as well, not just kind of supplementation. I think like it's easy to kind of see it as low hanging fruit and just take a bunch of NAD and think that you don't have to like work out or like eat healthy and all that stuff. What are the main factors that you've kind of picked up along the way that can impact our NAD levels and function the most?
So, I mean, I think we do see an increase in NAD with calorie restriction, right? So there's basically a general correlation with health, with things that we know are going to make you live longer or be healthier. Animals that are calorie restricted, at least in their skeletal muscle and in their fat tissues, get a boost of NAD. Mm-hmm. We see in obese animals, sort of contrarily, the NAD levels go down in the liver, at least a little bit, and maybe a bit in skeletal muscle.
And go down in weight or go down in NAD levels?
So NAD levels go down.
Okay, interesting.
In those tissues. Not that drastically, but even in some human studies now, there's beginning to be a little bit of evidence that NAD levels are lower with obesity.
Right. Oh, I see, when you've gained weight, not when we're fasting.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry. Okay. Maybe mixing up conditions here. But generally, I mean, the things you think of as being healthy is fasting, calorie restriction, exercise. Yeah. Exercise is the other major one, right? We'll boost NAD levels, at least in some issues. Overweight, obesity, sedentary lifestyle can decrease them.
Fair enough. So kind of that general template of stress the cells just enough to kind of create further growth. So you kind of regenerate. It's almost like analogous to muscle growth. That's kind of what I picture when I think of like autophagy regeneration, and that's linked to better NAD function. Is that more or less how you see it?
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, you know, we may learn more as we go on, right? We're just in the beginning days of sort of some of these interventions. That seems to be the general trend.
That seems like parallel across like, you know, temperature theory and fasting and you know, cardiovascular stimulus, all the just like getting the right dose of stimulus to kind of create that progressive overload and development in tissue. Cool. That said, I want to get a sense of your personal take on, I mean, there's NAD supplements blowing up all over the world, and there's different kind of protocols that are recommended and like different side supplements to take with it. Do you have a recommendation on a dosage or a profile of NAD precursor supplements that you recommend?
I honestly don't think we're at the stage where we can do that in a rational way that we can back up with evidence for humans.
Fair enough. Yeah. We're still kind of speculating and hoping for the best.
Yeah. I mean, there's different opinions out there. They're easy enough to find. And, you know, people feel very passionately about their point of view on some of these. But the human studies are, you know, at this point still consisting of, you know, N of 10 for a week often. And, you know, I think we just have to get, you know, more people, longer time points to really make a confident recommendation. I'm afraid fair I'd enough. Look back and really regret whatever I said.
Yeah. That's totally fair. I don't want to back you in a corner. That's all good. So let's shift into your personal habits around health, wellness. Obviously, you live this, you're around it. I'm curious to hear what your priorities are around your personal health, well-being, longevity, your own lifestyle habits. What are your top priorities on the list, and what do your habits look like around those habits or hobbies?
Sure. I think the top priorities are the obvious ones, right? I think sometimes people get too distracted with, you know, what pills can I take?
Yeah.
First of all, you know, quit smoking, right? If you sort of graph out what affects human lifespan, like that's just the top of the list. I mean, you have to be morbidly obese to have it compared to the shortening of lifespan you would get from smoking.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So I think it's important to say that first, right? And then, you know, my next two priorities are the ones with a lot of evidence too, right? Make sure I get enough exercise and make sure I'm eating enough vegetables and fruit, right? In my diet. So those are the things I want to take care of first. Not that I do a perfect job of that all the time, but if I'm sort of checking myself, you know, to see what I can improve, it's, you know, add another exercise, another workout this week, you know, eat a little bit healthier meal, skip McDonald's, you know.
Yeah.
I think those are, you know, the clear things that everyone should do, you know, without hesitation. You know, as far as supplements and lifestyle changes, I guess I do try to eat intermittently. Practice a mild form of intermittent fasting. I mean, I try to make sure I don't eat in, you know, for more than a 12-hour window in any day. I try to make sure I'm fasting at least 12 hours.
Okay.
And usually to go beyond that, more like 16.
16 and 8. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you do extended fasts as well?
I don't. Or at least not routinely. I mean, I have kind of played around with it to see how I felt. But, you know, I find 16 hours is about my limit where I start to feel like it's unpleasant. I'm pretty adapted to the point where I don't even really feel hungry at 15 hours, but like at 16, it's suddenly time to eat and I'm not ready to routinely overcome that.
I feel you. Fair enough. Cool. Awesome. Anything else, any other nuggets before we wrap this up?
Well, I was going to mention as far as supplements, I haven't committed to anything long-term. I mean, I take all these things that we work on, you know, intermittently myself, just to, you know, from my own information, to kind of see if I feel different taking them.
Yeah, fair enough.
Like resveratrol or nicotinamide riboside or mononucleotide I've tried, you know, and I honestly, you know, can't claim from my anecdotal evidence that I've, you know, had any you know, inspiring effects. I'm certainly, you know, I think they're, you know, generally safe and interesting to play around with, but and again, don't have an evidence-based regimen that I could recommend yet.
Fair enough. Cool. Awesome. Well, Joe, this has been an awesome chat. I really appreciate you sharing your wisdom with the crew. What is the best means for people to follow your content and learn more about your research?
Still mostly papers. I don't have much of a Twitter presence. Do you?
Fair enough.
You know, the field has gotten a little bit interesting in terms of Twitter, but it seems like an awful commitment to post as many times as some of these people are doing.
Do you have a profile yet on Google Scholar?
I do have a profile in Google Scholar.
Okay, fair enough. At
your university, and obviously we're trying to get publications out there as quick as we can.
Cool. Awesome. Well, we'll link to your, at least that, in the show notes. Thanks again, Joe. This has been an awesome chat. Appreciate the time.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Cool. Well, thanks for tuning in, guys. And we'll see you next time on HealthSpan Academy. Hey, what's up, guys? Thanks for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Thank you so much for supporting this channel. This has been a fun project. We're growing in viewership every single week, and we obviously couldn't do that without you. So thank you for continuing to tune in. I really hope you're getting value out of the programming and the content. Just wanted to give you a heads up. I've been working on a book on health and longevity the last couple of years, been collaborating with my colleague, Dr. Dan Vitale, who's an expert in the field as well. And we've basically just kind of summarized the literature, some of the techniques that we found really useful in the world of biohacking, what our exercise regimen looks like, what's, you know, cardio type stuff is going to help us live longer and healthier, mobility work, nutrition. We've covered the whole spectrum, everything that you can basically be in control of in your health and fitness kind of moving forward to help you live as healthily as possible for as long as possible. And it's available free for download. So if you click on the YouTube banner, you'll see a link to download the blueprint. It's also on our Instagram profile. Or on the website, you can click on fivepillarmethod.com/optimize to get your free copy of the book. And I hope you enjoy it. Hope you're keeping well. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.